Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, bringing you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. Dallas Campbell is one of the most celebrated science television presenters in the UK. He has been communicating complicated ideas to the nation for years, including on television's most popular factual shows, Bang Goes the Theory and The Gadget Show. But what does it really take to engage an audience? In this interview, Dallas shares the secrets of effective communication. If you enjoy today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice and visit ii.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers. I'll now hand you over to our host for this interview, Ginesh Taylor.
Hi, everybody. I'm sure most of you in this audience will have heard of Dallas, seen one of his programs before. So I was going to say, for those of you who don't know me, what I should say is I'm a molecular biologist and I do a bit of science communication. So in this context, I get the best seat in the house for asking the questions to Dallas about how to communicate science. So, first question, Dallas, you should probably remember this, but like, how did you first get into science communication and broadcasting?
It's a good question. So I'm not a molecular biologist, I should say from the outset. And in fact, I'm not a scientist at all. And people are always slightly confused, I think, when they meet me, because generally when you see science on television, it's done by scientists. It's done by Professor Brian Cox, or it's done by Professor Alice Roberts, or it's done by Richard Dawkins, whoever it is. It's generally scientists telling you stuff. I actually started working in, this is, 30 years ago, I actually started off working in drama. So I trained as an actor, doing drama for a while. I wasn't a very good actor because I was an actor who, instead of reading Stanislavski and such, I spent too much time reading New Scientist, because I was always really interested in science, about how the world works and how nature works. I just wasn't a scientist. I'm just, in the same way that I love listening to music, but I don't play music. Or I like watching sport, but I don't actually play the sport. But for somehow, I was always really confused that science is somehow sort of other. Like, why is it that if you're interested in science, people just kind of assume you must be a scientist? Anyway, I was living in America at the time, and I was in a bar, the short stop it was, I remember very clearly, with my friend Jonathan. And we were having just a discussion about this, about science. And we were both actors. We both weren't involved in science or academia at all. And we had this conversation. We were like, well, why is it only scientists get to talk about science? Why don't we should do a show rather than Professor Ganesh telling you stuff.
I've been promoted in the last 10 minutes.
Telling you all about molecular biology. Why didn't we get like an idiot to go and like find stuff out? Like a kind of bottom up kind of science show. And this was 2003, actually earlier, 2001. So this is a long, long time ago. So anyway, we came up with this science show idea, and we thought, well, who's the idiot? Well, I'll do it because I'm really bad at science. I don't have any science qualifications. I failed all my science O levels, et cetera, et cetera. And so we did this show. And we managed to sell it to the Discovery Channel, like bizarrely. We were like, okay, so we got to make the show for the Discovery Channel. And the premise of the show was each week Dallas goes on a mission to try and do an impossible thing. And it was called Dallas in Wonderland. And so mission one was, this week I'm going to break the men's 100 meters record. And then this week I'm going to journey to the center of the earth. And then this week I'm going to get abducted by aliens. And so by not being able to do the thing each week, you learn about the thing. So for example, the 100 meters episode we did, by me trying to do this ridiculous task, which is quite clearly I'm not going to be able to do it, but you learn all about sports science, you learn about sports psychology, you learn about biomechanics and training and all this kind of stuff. And it was actually a good show, but we were obsessed by, it was right when The Life Aquatic came out, and I was really obsessed by that film, by like the aesthetics of that film. And Bill Murray in that film. And I really like the idea of just like a bunch of idiots kind of having adventures, and, you know, which is what that film is about. But also it's in that kind of Wes Anderson way, beautifully shot, wonderful color palettes. And the music was really amazing. And I remember the band Devo, who are this 80s pop band. Some of you will remember Devo, the lead singer, one of the members of Devo, Mark Mothersbaugh, does a lot of music and does all the music for Wes Anderson's films. And I was looking at the sleeve notes of The Life Aquatic, and I noticed that Mark Mothersbaugh had done the music. And I'm like, we totally want that kind of music for our show, for our Discovery show, because we want it to feel a bit like The Life Aquatic. And I noticed that, but just by reading the sleeve notes, that he had a recording studio just down the road from where we were living. So, this is on Hollywood Boulevard. It was the old Rocky Bullwinkle Museum. And so I thought, fuck it, I'm going to go. And we drove down there. I remember knocking on the door.
Oh my gosh,
and he answered. And I'm like, listen, this is ridiculous. We're doing this show for Discovery. We've been meeting composers. All we've been saying is we want someone a bit like Mark Mothersbaugh. And eventually he sort of did the music for us.
Love it.
So we were a bit arch for Discovery. Huh. We were a bit kind of... It was a bit, what I think we were, I don't know, we got fired after one season of doing this thing. And we were ejected back to the UK for being too...
Too avant-garde.
Well... I don't think we're being avant-garde, but they were like, could you do like a Shark Week episode? Like it was when Discovery were all about, you know, they wanted Shark Week every week, and we weren't really that.
Dallas gets eaten by a shark.
Anyway, so that was the answer. So that's kind of where it started. And then after that, I came back to the UK, and then I, you know, having done that show and having sort of created that idea of like idiot tries to find stuff out. Then I did, you know, stuff. I joined the BBC. Well, I did the Gadget show for a while, and then BBC stuff.
I mean, there's two things that come into my mind in that. There's one thing that you talked about, which is the aesthetic of the show in itself, like the sort of quirky side of things.
Yeah.
Let's park that for a second. I think it sounds an awful lot like the fact that you basically, as a non-expert, sorry.
No, I am a non-expert, yeah.
But I think that actually might be part of the appeal, it sounds like. Like, do you feel like that's what you brought to these sorts of...
Definitely. I think it's really important. When we're talking about science... still is seen as other people do science. So if you're not connected to science or academia, science is something else. And I think that's, well, A, it's a shame because science is too interesting just to be left for scientists to talk about.
Yeah, true.
And B, also, it's really important for the general populace, not just to, obviously, you know, to be educated in what science is and how science works, but also just because it's interesting, because science is just intrinsically an interesting thing to talk about. How the world works, how nature works, why things are the way they are, the things that we don't understand, which are, you know, for me, infinitely more interesting than the things that we do understand.
Yeah.
And that's like any other form of human culture, science should be there for everyone. And you mentioned Bangor's A Theory. We got to do this family science show on BBC One. And, you know, the reason I was on that show, you know, we had, you know, academics as well. So we had Liz Bonin on it, and we had Jem Stansfield, and we had Yan Wong. And my role was the kind of, you know, again, the sort of everyman. It's like me not being an expert, asking questions. I in a way, I have the license to ask the stupid questions because, you know, when you become a professor, it suddenly becomes harder to ask the stupid questions. For me, it's okay to ask the stupid questions.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole separate talk to be had about why it's not acceptable for some people to ask questions, whereas for others...
But it shouldn't be. It's ridiculous.
It shouldn't be like that.
We have a really silly culture of how we talk about science still. Yeah. And, our whole mantra of Bangor's A Theory was like taking science out of the lab and into people's lives.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, giving people permission to feel like they're allowed to talk about science. Because I think... Certainly for me, you know, years ago, I felt, oh, shit, science, I'm not allowed to kind of, that's something else.
Yeah. I mean, you've also talked about questions, right? So do you feel like, what came first, do you think, your curiosity about science or the fact that once you got into it, it becomes that much, like, you just, there's always a why the moment you're told any kind of scientific thing?
I think when I was at school doing science, I just didn't, it's not that I didn't get it, I didn't want to get it because I saw science as the thing that those people did, you know, and I was too busy listening to the Smiths.
These people.
Yeah, I was, you know, I was the Smiths because it was the 1980s, so I was listening to the Smiths and science was sort of over there somewhere. And it wasn't until, I guess, probably until my sort of early 20s. I mean, but then again, you know, even though science was over there, I grew up watching BBC Science. I used to love watching Tomorrow's World. You know, I was fascinated by that. I used to love watching, like everyone, I watched David Attenborough and I watched, you know, connections with James Burke and, You know, I grew up watching, you know, Apollo stuff happening because I'm of that age. So that was all in the background, and I found all that world very interesting, but I just didn't associate it with, you know, learning science. I didn't want to be a scientist.
Yeah.
In the same way that I like listening to Beethoven and I don't want to be a pianist. That's okay. I think it was sometime in my early 20s, actually, I chanced upon, actually it was the Royal Institution Christmas Lectures in, I think it was 91 or 92, and there was this guy presenting it whose name was Richard Dawkins. But I remember Richard Dawkins, this young, you know, rather attractive sort of professor, just talking very eloquently about evolution. I had a basic grasp of it, but I didn't really understand it. And he just explained it so beautifully, so simply, so elegantly. And I remember watching this Christmas lecture, and it was like the windows opening and this kind of draft coming in. I was like, why did no one, it's so interesting. Why the hell did no one tell me that when I was at school? And so I became really, really fascinated by that. And I remember reading, soon after that, I read The Blind Watchmaker, one of his books, absolutely fascinating. And then I worked with a director, this guy, Ken Campbell, and I sort of helped him he was doing a series called Reality on the Rocks, which is like my own sort of idea. Ken Campbell tries to go on a mission to try and understand quantum mechanics. And so I got really interested in the kind of that world of crazy stuff we don't understand. And so I just became really interested in the whys and the hows and the...
Let's double down on that point. So what do you think it was about that, the style of that particular science communication thing that you saw? Like, let's drill down on the communication point. What is it that you think is successful or accessible or not?
It was just simple. It was the simplicity of it. Mm. Like, behind any science, generally, there is a really simple idea that anyone can grasp. Even an idiot like me can grasp. And that's what I got. The wonderful thing about that particular lecture is that it wasn't... Very often, sometimes science communication, it gets obfuscated in a kind of word salad in order to make it look complicated, because somehow science must be complicated, otherwise, because I'm far above that. You know, when we were doing Bangos of Theory, for example, that was a 7:30, just after the One Show, BBC One TV show.
Yeah.
And our benchmark was, look, if, you know, my mum can't understand it, it doesn't go in the show. And that's kind of what it was. And we'd call my mum and like, do you understand this? And she'd be like, yeah, we understand that. And that's how it should be. But sometimes we get things like, oh, they're just dumbing down science. And I know anyone who uses the word dumbing down when they talk about science is a rude word. Because behind that is that idea that it's about making you feel superior.
Yeah.
And so for me, I make no apologies about making... Just telling the simple story of whatever it is that we're talking about.
I'm going to go completely off-piste here and take my privileges as the chair. So we've talked actually about, you know, we mentioned before about scientists maybe not feeling comfortable to be seen to not know the answer or asking questions. You've also said about this, like, needing to feel like I know and I do the imparting. This is how I do my communication, just so you know, like this. But... Am I allowed to ask, have you ever felt while you were preparing any of these shows that there was any kind of just like, who is this guy?
I think scientists who I really respect know. Because like good scientists, like, I don't mean in a kind of value judgment, but like proper scientists who have humility and are comfortable in their own skin. Bien dans sa peau, I think the French say. To be comfortable as one's own skin. They don't mind it. They're happy to sort of talk about and talk openly and talk plainly. It's the kind of scientists who are enthralled with themselves, like to sort of slightly obfuscate and like to sort of talk in a way that makes them sort of feel very superior. And actually, when I was doing Bang, and what I like to do, and the thing that I'm, I suppose, most proud of is making scientists feel comfortable about being human beings and actually just talking like a human being. And it's a problem with academia generally, because with academia, like most areas in life, everyone's worried about what's my boss going to think? What, you know, I've got to say it like this, and oh, I'm going to be misrepresented by the media and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And actually, the good side, you know, good people and good communicators are people who, like, you know, don't worry about any of that stuff and just talk. It's why people like Carl Sagan was such a great science communicator, because he just talked like a human being and we could all relate to it, and he would just tell you the story, and there was a simplicity and an ease to it. There wasn't any, you know, anything to wasn't it wasn't in any way self-serving.
That's really interesting.
But yeah, sometimes scientists can get a little bit, oh God, I'm going to be, you know, I've got to, it's more, you know.
Yeah.
And I like to be able to talk to scientists and hopefully get them just to chat. And, you know, humor is a good way of doing that. And actually just try and be, you know, not like funny all the time, but actually just speak in a relaxed way.
Yeah, to see the lighter side of things.
Yeah. The thing is about, you know, science is, and part of the problem with science, and we see this, we've seen this through the pandemic, is, you know, people get their scientific knowledge from people they trust, okay, and whose values they share. They don't get it from just being told facts. Facts is not a good way of understanding the world around you. You know, facts are facts. You know, we're humans. We understand story. We understand shared values, shared experiences. And that's why you see so much polarization in the way science is communicated, particularly in the pandemic, because, you know, if you are a sort of a right-wing libertarian and you have a deep mistrust of governments and institutions and of science and the media, whatever they tell you, however loudly they shout facts, it's not gonna hit home. That's the issue. So I've always tried to sort of be a slight bridge between academia and the public.
There's something interesting in that already. The idea of how people learn and the kinds of characters they're willing to learn from, actually.
Yeah.
And it's interesting you say about similarity, because, I mean, this is just my personal opinion now, but if you can only learn from people with whom you agree upon with different things, you get into pretty hairy territory pretty fast, no?
It's really difficult. But I think scientists and everyone needs to understand how human psychology works and why we sort of get ourselves into a mess and why just shouting facts at people isn't going to change the thing is, you know, me, I spend all my time with scientists. You know, I work with scientists, I work with academics and I work in the media. So I'm naturally, these are people I trust because they're part of my tribe. But if you're not that, and if you have a deep mistrust of the media,
yeah,
and if you think scientists are all a bunch of liberal, you know, elitist, and you're not that, then it makes sense, you know, and people, and they're just talking to you like you're an idiot, then it makes sense that you're going to, you know, you're going to have different values.
I mean, so in that case, let's segue into this. If I was to say to you, Dallas, I ring you up, Dallas, I'm off to do a really tough gig. I need to try and explain to a really really questionable audience, or I'm worried that they're not going to be there for it. And I want to tell them about whatever, genome editing, human beings, let's say.
Yeah.
How do I, A, persuade them to listen to me? And B, I mean, the title of the session was how to get them excited about it, because that's like a different gradation. What would you be saying to me, apart from don't do it?
No, I would say do it and just be your natural, charming self. It's funny, I went to a flat earth convention in Birmingham a couple of years ago because I was
there's a backstory to this.
Yeah, because I was really interested in this question. I was interested in here's a really interesting phenomena. Why is it, you know, people weren't talking about flat earth 10 years ago. Why are we suddenly talking, why is everyone believing in the earth being flat? And I went and there were some PhD or postdoc astrophysicists from Imperial there. Actually, it's funny because I think most of the people there were actually people like me trying to figure out what the hell was going on. There's actually very few flat earth. No, there was quite a lot of flat earth.
Actually, it was set up by the psychologists. It was a honey trap interested in this kind of thing.
But the interesting point was, and there was a challenge to a debate, not challenge, that's the wrong word, but there was agreed there was going to be a friendly discussion. And what was interesting was just how bad the postdocs were at explaining why the earth was round. Like, it was really difficult. And the reason it was difficult, because their points of reference or their evidence was things like NASA and the science and everything else. And the flat earth is, they're not anti-science. They can talk about gravitational waves and they can talk about accretion disks and they can talk about all the stuff. It's scientists they don't trust. So if I say to the flat earthers, look, here's a picture of Apollo, you know, this was taken by Apollo 8, 1968, you know, and it's the famous pale blue, you know, the famous, you know, blue marble shot, you know, Earthrise, whatever. You can see it. And they're like, ah, yes, but NASA's fake. So it's not the science they disagree, it's the scientists, it's the institutions. And that's the problem. And that, you know, we saw it in Brexit, a mistrust, polarization of suddenly institutions that we used to take for granted. And of course, it's all been amplified by social media. So suddenly these disparate groups, I mean, it was funny that the show Dallas in Wonderland that we were doing, we did a show about journeying to the center of the Earth. And the sort of act three of that show is a kind of joke. We went to see some people who believed the Earth was hollow. And then, you know, that was the kind of Louis Theroux-esque kind of end to the show. And actually, flat Earth didn't exist then. People believed the Earth is hollow. But it was such a fringe idea. But now, like, flat Earth is, like, massive. It's, like, a huge thing because of YouTube, because of the way that social media algorithms are set up. You know, these kind of disparate kind of ideas suddenly find themselves and they sort of gravitate towards each other and these movements grow. But no, it's funny because, you know, you talk to the flat earthers, they'll tell you all the science and they'll talk to you about distances to horizons and the way that aeroplanes fly and all this kind of craziness. But they just don't believe in, so as soon as you say NASA, you're kind of, that's it. It's impossible to argue somebody out of an illogical situation if logic didn't get them there to begin with, so.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I mean, obviously, you know, I do science and I feel one of the things that's happened in the last few years, that's such a pretentious thing to say as well, isn't it? I do science. I don't mean it in that way, I'm sorry. I mean, as in, you know, I'm a scientist professionally, but I think one of the things that's happened in the last few years is because there's this sort of increasing trend of like mistrust in science and science institutions in particular, there's this sort of like, you know, you should go out there and like, it's your job to fix this to the scientists. There's increasing pressure on the scientists to get out there and do their best. But as you've kind of alluded, they aren't always the best at doing that. And then there's this sort of disparity between like, is the gap between the mistrust and the fact that, you know, scientists are the ones doing this thing so large that you do actually need, I hate to use this phrase, but like a middleman. Do you actually need somebody, do you need like a vector, like a cleansing system so that they don't have to mistrust you? Or what do you think?
I think it's a bit of everything. I think, you know, for scientists, I think this idea of outreach was a bit frowned upon. If you're a serious scientist, you know, a decade ago and you did outreach, it was seen as a little bit kind of, you know, serious scientists don't do that.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's definitely changing and for the better that serious scientists are expected to kind of go out and talk to the public. And not in a kind of hectoring, lecturing way, but just like talk about it I think we have a fundamental problem in that I think very often people don't really understand what science is. I think people tend to think, or people who are perhaps a little bit anti-science, and I'm using, it's probably the wrong term, but they think of science as a kind of a book of facts, as this is authority, we tell you stuff. Science isn't that. Science is just a verb. It's a way that you do, it's a method. It's a way that you kind of explore the world. It's not about facts and things. You know, when I see anti-vaxxers and stuff online going, oh yes, but science said masks didn't work, and now they say masks do work, as if that's like, No, that's what science, it doesn't know anything. You know, science looks at the best data at the time and then it changes its mind all the time. And I think people very often don't really understand that because they think of science as the science of school lessons. They think of like, science is facts, this is what it is. You know, this, that, and the other. And science is constantly changing its mind because that's what science is.
Yeah.
It's a filter, it's a lens on which we see the world. The idea is it's free from your biases and my biases. It looks at data coming in and it makes assumptions until better data comes in, then it changes. You know, and people still, I think, very often see that as somehow a flaw.
I mean, but also, I mean, we've talked about human psychology. I think it's also kind of a bit uncomfortable for a lot of people because a lot of what science is about is saying, yes, probably, kind of. It is like this to the best of our ability. There's no like clickbait title. There shouldn't be in science.
Uncertainty
is
the engine of science. There you go. Uncertainty
is a clickbait title right there.
It is. It is. But it's true. Uncertainty is what makes science work. It's what science is. It's how... And what scientists do all day is try to sort of manage that uncertainty and try to kind of figure out, you know, how can we make the error bars less, if you like. And it's nothing more than that. And the problem is when scientists start lecturing, especially if it's, you know, if you're lecturing, you know, people with perhaps different values or different ways of seeing the world than you are, then what you do is you make them assume a sort of authority and people become resentful of that. You know, and misinformation spreads and then social media companies say, right, we're going to ban that. And then they see that their thing being banned is further evidence of some elitist conspiracy, and the whole thing kind of grows and gets kind of crazy.
But that's a hard ask, isn't it? How do you get people excited about something that is deeply uncertain and they can't?
Well, no, I think it's exciting. I think if you can sell uncertainty as a good thing, as an interesting thing, as an exciting thing to the public, and that's what I've always tried to do. It's like, well, you know, we don't know. That's why I like doing stories about the science that we don't know, because there is uncertainty and we don't know. And if you can sell that as a concept, you know, and couch it in interesting story and understand how story works and stop shouting at everyone on Twitter and stop being, you know, and stop thinking you're so virtuous on Twitter and you guys are idiots.
Yeah.
Then you that has to stop. That whole kind of, you know, everyone thinks they're in the right. Everyone thinks they're the virtuous ones. Everyone with their sort of, look at me being kind, you know, and everyone needs to just kind of calm down and actually start kind of slightly building bridges, I think.
Amazing. With that, I'd like to thank Dallas for his time. Thank you, everyone who came today. And keep the conversation going.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Philosophy for Our Times. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice and visit ii.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig. Inspiring kid confidence.